Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
What does a night out with Jonathan Wilson look like?
Holding a wine glass in a really poncy way and pontificating about things and telling long, drawn-out anecdotes.
Yeah.
And then eventually going home because everyone wants to go somewhere else and he kind of can hag it.
Yeah, fair enough. I've heard you're a boozer though, Miguel. So, and what, is it better or worse than seeing James Montague and Philippe Auclair going at it?
Oh, I mean, that was entertaining. I wouldn't want to see that every night.
No. What, every other night? A bit too much. All right, fair enough. Miguel, you've written an investigative report into the imbalance in football at the top level in 2020. It was published yesterday in The Independent under the title How Modern Football Became Broken Beyond Repair. And it references several troubling incidents and trends in terms of competitions won, win percentages of the top teams, domination of leagues by super wealthy clubs, including first ever 100-point seasons in several countries, unprecedented trebles, etc., etc. And I wanted to pull one particular quote from the article out. And you said, the concentration of money has brought a concentration of quality and thereby success. It's a really informative piece. It's also a deeply sort of bombastic and troubling one. I mean, how concerned should we be by this in European football and why?
Well, I think as the end of the article sums up pretty much, and this is from talking to people at the top level of the game, involved in the discussions about potential distribution, the calendar. And I know this has come up for, this has been hovering for years, the threat of a Super League. But it does actually feel like the game is kind of splinter a little bit, and we're at that almost that tipping point where I think as Nicola Cortesi said to me about the former Southampton chief executive, the forces interested in the Super League might sense their opportunity, or sense the opportunity for some sort of drastic restructuring of the Champions League, which is very much on the agenda. And the worst thing about that is, even though that's obviously a grotesque scenario that kind of goes against everything we follow football for and why most people are in it, it's actually arguably desirable because it's the only potential solution to what's happening in football, which is predictability almost across the board. And, you know, people might point to various examples in leagues, like, say, at Atalanta, sudden surge. But the worst thing about that is that these are increasing exceptions in what are undeniable wider trends, which is predicted. I mean, I pointed out in the piece, but right now, across Europe, and this is only the most extreme example of what we're talking about, 13 of the 54 leagues, that's a quarter, are basically either undergoing their single longest winning streak in terms of one team winning it, mm-hmm. or the single longest portion of domination, like Dynamo Zagreb have won 13 of 14 leagues. Bayern Munich had previously only ever won three leagues in a row. They're currently going for eight. And the fact this goes from right from the top to from Italy and Germany through the middle to Austria and on down to the very bottom, Andorra, illustrates the depth of the problem.
But I think it's interesting, isn't it? The fact that we see this problem as very much traditionally, if we go back, say, 5 or 6 years before the current, or even further, before the current dominance of Paris Saint-Germain, Barcelona, who've won 8 out of 11, you can say them as well.
Juventus.
Yeah, exactly. You think of it as very much a second or third tier league kind of problem, don't you?
Yeah.
Because when you think of leagues where the same teams win every year, and it's actually not the case at the moment, but you think Greece, you think Norway, you think Olympiakos, you think Rosenborg. Yeah. Exactly. And that's somewhere where, you know, you can squarely lay the blame in terms of that league, in terms of those leagues, at the feet of the Champions League, can't you? Because if you're Olympiakos, or if you're Rosenborg, or I suppose you could look at Ajax at the moment.
Yeah.
The fact that they've trousered this extraordinary amount of money from an unexpected run to the Champions League semi-final, very unexpected run to the Champions League semi-final. They did well to get into the groups in the first place. Plus the fact with them, of course, they sold De Ligt and De Jong for absolutely extraordinary amounts, which was pure profit because they were youth products. If Ajax don't get it wrong, they should realistically be champions for the next six seasons. But I think the fact that you think like that shows you really what the problem is.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of Champions League money, I mean, we've seen it if you look through the Deloitte reports of the last couple of years. When, say, Chelsea haven't made the Champions League, it's not been such a big deal because they've got the Premier League money, because they offset it with player trading, the way they've sold academy products and kids they've bought really young, just like Manchester City, I suppose. So really, this has moved away from being something we can squarely lay at the Champions League, hasn't it?
Well, I think the Champions League is actually, it's two levels of problem. First of all, it's that direct problem, you say. It's the amount of money it pumps into clubs, which, and I think that's had the most distortive effect on all the clubs outside the elite.
Like Dynamo Zagreb are the ones
I'm thinking. Yeah, right? Exactly.
Absolutely. It completely changes a league like that. It makes you immensely powerful.
Yeah, and that's even only by getting to the group, or getting to the qualifying stage, not even the group.
Yeah.
And it's similar in Ireland. Dundalk went and got it 2 years in a row, now won 5 out of 6. So the Champions League, it gives you that direct influx of money. And say if Atalanta were to go far this season, they'd benefit from a similar thing.
They've already gone beyond the group, so sure, that's going to make a
so that'll probably get them it'll end up getting about 40 million. But the other side of it then is, and it's not just a financial capital, it's also kind of, I suppose, a social capital.
What, in terms of branding recognition?
Yeah, exactly. Because the Champions League has become such a be-all and end-all that to be in it now gives you such a massive platform that it just increases your scope for what is becoming one of the most relevant issues in all this, the amount of money teams can make. And I think this probably speaks to the wider problem in that the reason super clubs exist basically is because there's a handful of clubs that have a truly global fan base. So, and if you look at that in purely business terms, which I referenced Soriano, the current Manchester City chief executive, former Barcelona, in the book, but that's essentially a massive global audience, a market that you can exclusively exploit, and it's extremely difficult for any other club to build this without, 15 years of regular competition in the Champions League.
So you're saying that a lot of the benefits of this are almost intangible because it makes the club more visible and therefore able to get into these different areas all around the world in a way that's quite hard to measure but tells its own story longer term.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
It's something that's worked perhaps for Atletico Madrid, you would say, under the Simeone era. I mean, they're not quite a super club, but they're definitely pushing up into that sort of area. If you look at the amount of times they've been in the Champions League, if you look at the amount they're able to spend on transfers now, if you look at the stadium, all those are things, and presumably they hope those will take root further in years to come. I mean, I think if you were going to have a closed Super League, if that were actually to happen, they would be... They'd get in, they're one of those teams that are just about on the cusp, I suppose.
Yeah. Like Spurs, actually, yeah.
Yeah, Spurs. Mm. I suppose Dortmund would be another one.
Dortmund, because you need another German team, really.
Yeah.
And because of that kind of allure they have.
Isn't it, forgive me, this is a stupid question, but we are going to talk about a European Super League, something that kind of comes up every so often when you do these types of shows, ever since I've been doing them. Is it not beneficial for the said European Super League to just have as many teams as possible?
Well, no, because what they want is the teams...
Why would they not have a Dortmund or not
have a... Well, what is really relevant to this is the teams with the biggest TV markets. And because the whole principle, and it's what's causing a crisis in the global football calendar now, and why the likes of Florentino Perez are pushing for, you know, FIFA's Club World Cup idea. What they want is more matches against the biggest teams, because they're the most glamorous, most lucrative matches. The more of those you play, the more money you get.
But I mean, surely that's, I mean, and perhaps it, and this is exactly why you've written the article. I mean, there's obviously several reasons why you've written it, but isn't that just like horrendously short-sighted?
Because of course
you're going to generate exactly the same problem you're generating now, which is like the predictability of it. People are, you know, just because, you know, you like having a, you know, lie in once a week and staying in bed till 11. If you do that every single day for your entire life, it becomes quite boring.
Yeah,
right? Surely there must be a plan beyond that.
Well, but this is what's happened in football. I mean, and you know, I know this is a European podcast, the Premier League already proves it. It was initially a breakaway, and now we're getting to the point where there's going to be a breakaway of a breakaway.
These
kind of ever decreasing circles of greed. And actually, it's David Goldblatt who puts it like that in the piece, where he talks about basically this death spiral between a handful of clubs, and for what purpose? Because it's actually not like they're making that much money out of this in relative terms. For like football...
compared to big business.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, Manchester United aren't the size of Greggs.
No.
Neither are Barcelona or Real Madrid, which is...
Isn't the Simon Cooper... I don't know if it's still accurate now, but when Simon Cooper wrote the book that kind of talked about this for the first time, to my knowledge, he said that Man United's 10-year revenue or something is like, what, Tesco making a quarter like that. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But that's... Yeah, and... So it is about... just those extremely glamorous matches for them. But I mean, I suppose the most favourable way you could put that, even though obviously the idea is horrendous, is that it would be like some sort of European NFL, where it's just this exceptionally glossy product between a group of clubs who are all of similar resources, just kind of crashing against each other. Now, you could say the knockout stages of the Champions League are like that, but just obviously in elimination form, which makes them so good. And at the same time, it is this... I mean, that's why I put it in the... as you put in the intro, the concentration of quality. I mean, the flip side of this is, and what's so seductive about it and why it's so successful, is because we've probably never had a quality of... there's never been a quality of football like this. I think it's the exponential growth in the quality of the game due to all these factors, which is the collection of so much quality from so many areas at a handful of clubs. Is just
the question is, with the product being driven so vigorously, is that something that you can maintain? Because I don't know what you think, but I've talked to a couple of people about this, and I think that the feeling this season is that the quality of football all the way across Europe, and I include the elite clubs in that, is not what it should be. I mean, there are a few rare exceptions, but I have to say, I think Bayern Munich would be in a better position to be challenged by a stronger league. You can say the same for Juventus. Barcelona are still hanging about the top when they shouldn't really be with the season.
But isn't that
got
an indictment in itself? Like Barca, it's almost like through a pure critical mass, and Leo Messi, they're still just hanging in there when they should almost be having a Manchester United season.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I do think there's... I don't know, if people did look a little bit further ahead, I think you look at Paris Saint-Germain and the problem they have at the moment, or more specifically, the problem that Ligue 1 has at the moment, because I think you look at the television rights there who've been picked up by MediaPro, which is a Spanish company, who've still not completely said how... they've got the rights from next season, but they've not said... like which sort of channel they're going to form, what it's going to be called, how they're going to diffuse it, all that sort of stuff. And it's causing quite a lot of consternation in France. But I think the reason you've ended up at that point is because, of course, Al Jazeera, which became BeIN in Europe and in America and the Middle East and what have you for sport, the way they did it, they came in at Paris Saint-Germain and they thought, right, we're going to have our share of the TV market at the same time. So I don't know. It's just like, say, when Manchester City had taken over, if the owners of Manchester City had bought a load of the TV rights to the Premier League as well, it's a similar thing. But what I think the Qataris didn't realise or didn't really take ownership of quickly enough in France is the fact that if you're going to be so much stronger than everyone else, and especially in France, and this will apply to other countries, but it particularly pertains to France, the fact that they're so into the idea still of the sport. They feel sport is too commercial, and they feel it should be sport. It should be competitive, and all that sort of stuff. And immediately you had like Jean-Michel Aulas of Lyon, for example, saying, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you lend us a couple of your players who can't get in the team, because it'll make the league competitive, you know? So he's asking for, I think at the time, Mamadou Sakho, maybe Adrien Rabiot, players like that. And there's one side of you that think he's a bit of a cheeky bastard, isn't he? But actually, he's got a point, because now you've got to a level with Ligue 1 where it's quite a turn off for a lot of the French sporting audience, because as you say, that innate unpredictability of football, which is something that's so precious to the viewing experience, simply isn't really there anymore, despite the odd season where you've had Montpellier and Monaco.
Yeah, and it reminds me of that. I don't know if you guys have read David Miller's book, Racing Through the Dark. He talks about how he was fed up of being told he was the first clean rider back.
Yeah.
And almost like he was having a different competition within the same competition with other people because of the doping involved. But Miguel, what would you say to people who say, hang on a minute, you're going a bit over the top here, because essentially what is at the very core of this is not just what you're talking about, but it's the idea of ownership of top clubs. Like the Juventus family, Agnelli family's worth $14 billion. You've got the Qataris involved in City and PSG. You've got Abramovich at Chelsea. You've got all these things happening. There's nothing to stop that going on, and that kind of makes it very imbalanced too. So I don't think there's anything in your article about how we address that problem as well.
But there's actually a bit of an oddity there. I mean, I suppose this is the reason FFP came in, is because, well, even though Abramovich was ironically one of the people to push it, but once he was established, which I suppose was the point he went
kind of
for
he wanted to pull the ladder up.
Yeah, right? So it was a bit, I mean, FFP was initially to stop situations like Manchester City. Yeah, the issue is, first of all, it was actually the explosion of money in football which gave it this kind of global size. It was specifically that which made it attractive to all these sort of interests, like Abu Dhabi. It's what we come back to this point I made a few minutes ago, where they're not really investing in this for money. It's investing in it for something else, particularly the likes of Abu Dhabi.
Soft power, diplomacy, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Global renown.
Exactly. But what FFP has done then is actually, and is it, Goldblatt makes this point in the piece, that FFP could have been brilliant had it been brought in the 90s when it actually would have, you know, nipped a lot of these issues in the bud. But what it does now is basically kind of almost reinforce the glass ceilings.
Mm. It's kind of a bit like when they put measures in to sort the housing market out, but it doesn't. The ship has sailed, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just kind of window dressing around it.
Totally.
The ship sailed,
So we've got a situation now where we've got what I'd say about 8 clubs with the potential of the 2 Milan clubs because of their global base, who have, because of the way football is structured, if they maximise their massive global audiences, the only way you can actually compete with them is with a massive takeover. And if we're looking for these sort of, a lot of these takeovers are pretty much immoral.
Yeah.
I mean, Qatar should never have been allowed to take over PSG. Abu Dhabi should never have been allowed to take over Man City. The Glazers should never have been allowed to take over Man City. There should have been protections in places. But this is the situation now where you basically need some sort of massive takeover to compete
of every club.
And I mean, the Swedish situation is quite interesting, actually, in this sense. The Allsvenskan, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Mm. In the sense that they belatedly brought in almost something similar to the 50+1 rule. And I think the line Goldblatt again uses in the piece is basically the compensation for this lack of commercial enterprise is basically a greater football diversity. And I think that they got one of the most competitive leagues in Europe. It has meant that in Sweden, say, a lot of sponsors have gone to ice hockey because there's more controls on how you can market in Sweden and because of the potential scope of the clubs. But what it's done is that within the country, it's created a much more vibrant scene.
So can there be anything more diverse than Zlatan buying shares in Hammarby?
No, well, quite. We all saw the reception that got. You've pointed out the problem, Miguel. I mean, obviously, without trying to sound too cynical, that's, you know, part of the issue, but it's probably the easier part of the issue. So what do you think happens next, you guys, and what do you think should happen next?
Without putting too fine a point in it, football essentially needs some sort of Das Kapital, distribution revolution. But that's just not going to happen. One of the reasons this is going to happen, if you look at, this is quite a basic point, but at the moment there's ongoing discussions to decide how UEFA prize money is distributed for the 21-24 cycle. At the moment, that's 7.3%. So that means that of all the money the UEFA competitions generate, Champions League, Europa League, 7.3% goes back into the clubs not competing in Europe. So that's a solidarity payment to try and, prevent the gaps getting bigger, but it doesn't. It kind of just reinforces the system, because that 7.3 has actually gone down from the last cycle from 8.5.
What should it be?
Well, I mean, the European leagues group wanted to bring it up to 20%. And the big club, I mean, the big clubs just want to reduce it further. Mm. And ultimately, UEFA are going to listen to the big clubs, because if you start talking about this sort of thing, as I again put in the piece, they'll just, you know, dangle the threat of some sort of breakaway or what, or they'll flex their power. Mm. I mean, and that's the most basic fact. I mean, redistribution of resources is really the only way to solve this. But there's too many vested interests for it to actually happen.
Would you go along with that, Andy?
Yeah, well, it's always an incredible, we talked about it before, it's an incredible balancing act for UEFA, because they want to try and keep the lid on any potential breakaway, but want to try and remain competitive at the same time, and want to include as many teams as possible, which is completely opposite to what the biggest clubs want. I mean, it's difficult in a way, isn't it? Because already you've had a changing of the parameters, in a sense, by the way the top four leagues get their four clubs directly in. The weird thing is how, and you know, we talked about, you talked in your piece, Miguel, about a few outliers. The biggest outlier so far is probably Atalanta, because they've been the team that's benefited from the fourth place finish in Italy, haven't they? And that's something that's really changed things for Italian football. But it'd be interesting to see especially how Italy reacts, because of those big leagues, Italy is the one that's benefited the most from that change. But like, the idea of a second group stage coming back is something that
used to be so dreary.
It was awful. Yeah. It was absolutely awful.
I feel like and we'll move on shortly, but I feel like on one hand I think, oh wow, when I hear guys who know much more about it than me talking about it, I think, well, it's going to implode, it's going to be, there's all sorts are going to go on. But I also, the thing that stops me sort of thinking that and saying that is that ever since I've watched football, people have said the same thing, and it's still miraculously still kind of here.
But that's the issue, and it's all these incremental shifts at every stage.
That's it.
So when this was first talked about 20 years ago, if you compare that, the situation 20 years ago is now so much more desirable now. And a classic example being, 20 years ago when you were watching Barcelona Real Madrid matches, they just weren't as predictable as they are now. They were beaten much more, they weren't winning games by as much. In fact, and that's an interesting case in itself, because in the 90s actually Barcelona Real won more games by 3 plus goals. That dropped in the 2000s, and it specifically dropped because of Spain's because more equal redistribution rights. That changed in 2004, and that's such a key cut-off point, because suddenly we had a situation where we had Deportivo and Valencia winning the league, to then this unbroken streak of Real Madrid and Barcelona bar Atletico.
Poi Trezeguet sulla destra, la palla sbistata, Nedved, attenzione, cerca il fondo, pallonetto, poi arriva d'alta, Del Piero, gol!
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
All right, guys, after just 10 weeks in charge of Hertha Berlin, Jurgen Klinsmann's dream, and it was a dream, appears to be over at least to some extent. The big man himself, after going to all that trouble to locate his coaching forms, has decided to step upstairs because he doesn't have the trust of the club, apparently. His quotes are textbook, Klinsmann. He says, "As head coach, I also need the trust of the people involved with this task, which has not yet been completed. Unity, cohesion and focus on the essential are the most important elements, especially in the relegation battle. If they are not guaranteed, I cannot exploit my potential as a trainer and therefore cannot live up to my responsibility." He was only supposed to coach to the end of the season anyway, Andy, so is this just a fun story with not much substance to it, or does it tell us more about the Hertha project?
A bit of both. First thing, he's not a coach.
Yeah.
He's the manager, and that seems to have been the biggest problem. The fact that he wanted the sort of power that would have encroached on the sporting director, Michael Preetz, who's been there for a long time. When people talk about Klinsmann spending money, in January, Klinsmann's not really spent the money, has he? The club, backed by Lars Windhorst, has spent the money. And I think that's probably something that factors into this decision to a certain extent, because, yeah, they did spend more than anyone else, but they've not got Luca Toussaint for the moment. He's been loaned back to Lyon for the remainder of the season, as was the player's desire. So Christoph Piontek is the main one who's been added. It's a big project, and I wonder if he's got the stomach for things. I mean, it was always a huge criticism of Klinsmann at Bayern that he wanted to change too much too quickly.
Too quickly, yeah.
But I do think, on the other hand, there is this weird juxtaposition, because his desire seems to have been to be an old-style British coach, like a Wenger or a Ferguson, someone with that sort of overarching power. But you have to ask, if you're the investor, Lars Windhorst, you don't want that, do you? You know, you want him to advise on the board, and you want him to be the pretty blonde.
What actually is his role? You're talking about a glorified ambassador here.
I think you are. Absolutely,
he's a holistic figure.
He'd like to relocate Hertha to California.
Yeah, I mean,
do you know what? Maybe they'd be closer to the pitch.
It
wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if they ground shared with AFC.
What do you make of this then?
Well, I think there are a few things going on, and a lot of people, as you say, think classic Klinsmann, because you know this is something that's happened before. He's got this desire to get everyone on board with his philosophy, and not really take other people's opinions on board. The interesting thing is, when you talked about the manager versus coaching thing at the beginning, the appointment of the assistant, Alexander Nuri, is really important, because Nuri was previously the coach of Werder Bremen. In a different situation, you know, you could definitely imagine him as manager slash head coach of Hertha. He's been responsible for the tactics all the way. It's nothing to do with Klinsmann.
Which is basically the German national team as well.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, with Jogi Löw. Mm. And they very self-consciously got in a guy who is used to coaching a team. I mean, I don't know. Is Klinsmann like a Californian Brian Clough? Someone, I don't think he's a million miles away from that. I'm sure he would love to see himself.
Well, he's not Brian Clough. I know what you mean. Yeah. It's his force of personality that is his, and I suppose his personality and his career that it, and his ideas that are the value here, rather than, well, actually maybe not, more his overall ideas or his actual football ideas value.
And his image and his charisma because of where Hertha are trying to go as well.
But I think it also touches on another issue here, is that I suppose the conflict between when you're trying to impose some sort of medium to long-term vision with the very short-term necessity of staying up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's impossible to do that in that sort of time unless you're actually willing to take the hit of going down.
Well, Miguel, it's a process. I mean, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago when the guys pointed out what happened at Man City, and then we kind of compared that to Hertha. You know, Man City didn't start out by signing. I mean, they got a couple of big name marquee signs, but they were signing players like Gareth Barry and Rocky Santa Cruz because it's a process, right?
Well, you know why they did that as well. This is brilliantly put across in the book The Club. City's first strategy was basically to cripple the teams immediately around them. Mm. So that meant buying from Aston Villa, from Arsenal. Mm. So not only did it strengthen them, it completely scuttled those who they were immediately in competition with.
Was it not also the case that realistically, when you're the new kid on the block with this, and by the way, Windhorst isn't anywhere near the value of that anyway.
No.
But it's not realistic to go to a senior pro. They tried to go and get Kaká, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not going to get in the room with Kaká from day one, is the point I'm trying to make. Yeah. So the short term for Hertha is to kind of build gradually, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if it sounds to me, only based on what you guys have been saying, that Klinsmann's has he kind of misinterpreted his own role here? He needs to be the ambassador. He needs to be someone to give them authenticity because of the experience, because of the USP he's got as Jurgen Klinsmann.
But,
should he be anywhere near the playing side? I mean, should he be doing that?
No, I'm not convinced he should be. And I think you have to look at Preet's role in this as well, because the fact is they did start the season with a different coach, Ante Čović, and he was very much cut from Hertha cloth, and in terms of image, in terms of what he represented, he was a very, very long way from what Klinsmann is. You know, he's almost the polar opposite. So Klinsmann being parachuted in mid-season when he has such strong philosophy is an issue straight away. But it seems like something. It's very made up on the spot, because he was a member of the advisory board.
Yeah.
That pretty face at the front to make them into this, well, start making them into this big city club that they want to be. But then you parachute him into the playing context. All of a sudden, that's very, 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 very unusual. So he's like been a figurehead the whole way, and he seems concerned.
Sorry. Smashed my phone across.
You're very passionate about your Klinsmann. The anger.
Klinsy. A name that provokes no passion.
Yeah, Klinsy. Yeah, exactly. But I do feel like it's because if you look, the stakes are high here. Because if you look at what Windhorst is trying to do at Hertha, you get it, because they're an underperforming team in a big capital city, which will be an attractive destination for players, for fans, for a brand. But he's not got endless amounts of money. He can't spend 300 million on it.
If you're Ferran Soriano though, or someone like that, you're saying that is a market opportunity.
Yeah, it is.
One of Europe's major capitals, and it doesn't have any sort of football force. Mm. A major capital in one of Europe's biggest, wealthiest countries. There's a huge scope there.
What a start to the project it would be if they finished that first season as the second place team in Berlin.
That'd be amazing, wouldn't it? I mean,
and it could happen.
It could. It's in reasonable chance of happening, isn't it? I mean, it's happening at the moment.
Well, Union look a better team.
Yeah,
I'm not saying they've got better players, but they look a better team. They've got a better coach, clearly, in Urs Fischer. They've got continuity. I think everyone looked at that Union team at the start of the season and thought, there's no way they can stay up. But actually, you look at the experienced players. They've brought in the likes of Neven Subotic has been a great leader for them, and then you look at the ones that have sort of stepped up at a different level, and you look at Marius Buter, who scored those two goals of Werder last week. They've found their groove. They know what sort of team they are.
Yeah,
they're very, very strong at home. But exactly, it's so much built around their personality and the way they play at first try. You know, they've worked on what their strengths are. They've got a far stronger idea of who they are than Hertha.
I was talking to someone who used to work at Barcelona about this issue, and it was in relation to Manchester United, but it's a principle that basically goes across European football, and essentially what separates functioning clubs from non-functioning clubs, whatever context, is that first of all, you've got to decide what sort of club you are, and from that you're an identity of football. And everything builds from there. It means every sort of appointment and every sort of signing fits into that structure. Yeah. And I mean, it eliminates mistakes, makes everything streamlined. And that's essentially what's happened here.
You're talking about exactly, like, basically the team I think of when you say that is West Ham.
But isn't this...
How many weeks, let's get back to Hertha, but how many weeks are we going to be here before we find out that Klinsmann's left entirely?
Well, we'll wait and see, I suppose. I think the biggest problem for them is, and following on from what Miguel was saying, even if they weren't the most glamorous club, arguably one of the most boring clubs in the top flight before this, they did have a very strong idea of what they were. You look at Pal Dardai, Ante Čović, very, very sort of Hertha DNA kind of guys. And then all of a sudden...
What do you mean by that? Explain what you mean by that.
They're guys who know the club, who've got a history with the club. Mm. And that's something that's very important. And all of a sudden, it's like, right, we're going big time overnight. We don't know how we're going to do it, but we are going to do it. And here's Jürgen Klinsmann at the front. And because he's sort of come from inside the club to an extent, because he's already on the supervisory board, people think, oh, that's okay, it'll be a nice, smooth transition. But like with many things with Klinsmann, it's actually pretty jolty.
It feels very superficial, which was a lot of Klinsmann's career. In management, I should say, not playing career. And actually, Klinsmann's legacy in itself is quite interesting, because obviously he's kind of now the figurehead that basically is someone identified with the transformation of German football.
Yeah.
Whereas once again, he was just kind of, again, literally a figurehead while other people were doing the work below. And he was kind of the one, to be fair, like, that's not to say he was without input or without quality, but the whole thing kind of continued at a better rate without him. Goes to America, and there's a lot of debate about actually his effect there. And it's an odd legacy in terms of his post-playing career.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even him. He sent a coaching license across from California, is it?
Ik zei het, één keer sta je geen buitenspel. Paf, 1-1, bang, in de face.
All right, Porto brought themselves right back into the league title mix with a win over Benfica, 3-2 at the Dragão. It was a game packed full of incident.
And we have to say, Benfica president Luis Felipe Vieira has taken it very well, saying that we need overseas referees to ref the biggest chest games again, over here. The thing is, I think Bruno Lage, the coach of Benfica, he's in this position where, of course, he has to side with his president, but he's done quite well to turn the conversation around to, well, actually, there were things we could have done better. We could have defended a bit better. And it's normal for him to say that, I think, because Benfica had created such incredibly high standards before this. They were on the back of, what, 18, 19 successive away league wins? This was the first Liga away game under Bruno Lage that had not won. I mean, let that sink in. That's an incredible record. I mean, this goes right back to the start, doesn't it? Portugal's one of those countries, isn't it? But in terms of the title race being alive and kicking, Porto did everything they had to do. A really strong performance, particularly in the first half. And interestingly, these two sides both won in the Taça de Portugal semi-final second legs this week. So they're already going to meet as well in the Taça de Portugal, the cup final, in May 24th at Jamor, the old national stadium. So that should be quite interesting. Actually, Benfica got a real going over in the second leg of that game against the semi against Famalicão. And, you know, we talk about big teams balancing resources. Well, Famalicão, of course, they're new to the top flight this season. And they'd lost 3-2 in the first leg at the Estadio de Luz. Going into the second leg, they very consciously put in all their eggs in one basket. And Jorge Sosa, the coach, he rotated 10 players at the weekend when Famalicão played Guimarães. They lost 7-0 at home to Guimarães. That's how seriously they were taking it. And it nearly worked out for them as well. They drew 1-1 with Benfica, but totally penned Benfica in their half. I've not seen a team dominate Benfica like Famalicão did in especially the second half of that second leg. And Porto got to the final as well. So anyway, it keeps the rivalry all bubbling as well.
And Porto goalkeeper Iker Casillas, who is, I believe, still in recovery from a heart attack he had in July.
Yeah, he is still officially Porto goalkeeper Iker Casillas. He's not completely ruled out coming back.
And he's not played this season. He's doing some coaching.
And the idea is at some point they'll make him sporting director or some such.
Well, will
unless,
they?
Yeah, unless.
Let me get to it. He hasn't featured in this season, but he has reportedly announced his intention to run for the presidency of the Spanish FA. The 38-year-old has apparently sounded out Andres Iniesta and Carlos Puyol for advice about his bid. Now, you've kind of half answered that, Andy, but
Miguel, is this an avenue we always saw Ike heading down, and how do we kind of see it playing out? Because you were saying to me before we came in, he's known as a pretty clever guy, pretty intelligent.
And Spain, to be fair, has recently had this strand of players who go into these sort of roles. And you mentioned Puyol there, who has basically become a very prominent agent in Spain. So, I mean, maybe...
Is that what he's doing now? He's managing now.
Well, the thing is, if Barcelona weren't such an incredible mess upstairs... He would probably still be their sporting director, wouldn't he? So it could have gone even a different way.
So, I mean, first of all, there's that tradition. And then, secondly, Casillas himself is an interesting figure. I think this, it's something, to be honest, I always think of him now. Anytime he's beyond his goalkeeping and his two saves in the 2010 World Cup final against Robin, career moment. But I remember watching a video a few years ago, which was him and Fernando Hierro at the Real Madrid training ground, and someone was put into them, they were just throwing dates. I think this is on YouTube if you want to check it out.
You saw it a few years ago. You've mentioned Fernando Hierro there.
But Hierro wasn't playing. He was part of the Madrid staff.
Right.
And someone starts throwing dates out to them, and Hierro just doesn't have a clue. And Casillas, by just being given the date, is able to pinpoint the match, the Real Madrid score, the scorers, the sequence, and basically his performance.
When you've played that many games, that's pretty impressive.
Exactly. And it does speak, I mean, I think it speaks to, I suppose, a very kind of logistical, organised mind in that sense, with a lot of recall, incredible amount of recall. And I think he is a very sharp, progressive figure. It'll be interesting to see how he develops in this sort of role.
Do you think he'll become the president?
There's a lot of politics here. I mean, Tebas has backed him. And Tebas, there has been tension between Tebas and Rubiales. Only 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was at the launch of La Liga TV, where Tebas spoke. And he made a very, very pointed comment about the Spanish FA and why they're playing in Saudi Arabia in the first place.
He's a pugnacious guy, Tebas, isn't he?
It's quite interesting.
You were there as well, weren't you?
I was, yeah.
You guys sat in there, Poch?
I was right behind him, actually.
Were you?
So were you, were you?
Yeah,
we were together, yeah.
Great. And any insight? He's supposed to be journalist. Two of the best journalists in the country.
He's very, very good at avoiding questions.
Okay, that's something
that he's been working on in his time off, I think. But it is interesting what you were talking about, Miguel, about the open warfare between... the La Liga and the RFEF, the Spanish FA, because it's something that's come up again this week because, of course, Barcelona is a little sideways story, but I think it's worth underlining.
Sound like you, Andy.
I know. We've got room to talk. Barcelona are hoping to get their medical joker signed off. Like basically in Spain, just as in France, if you lose a player to serious injury, you can apply to the league to to get a player who's either a free agent or contracted to another club in the same league and sign them as a replacement. And so Barcelona are looking to do that for Ousmane Dembélé, who's been ruled out this week.
Another 6 months, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, with this serious injury, serious thigh injury. So he's going to be out for the rest of the league campaign and for the Euros. Now, normally, this is a formality that is waved through. Mm. But the RFEF are saying, we're still considering if Barcelona can do this. We've still got to sign it off. And La Liga are like, well, for Christ's sake, we've had 5 other instances of this season. And it's... You've not got involved, so why do you need to approve this? But it's just really Barcelona are a bit of a... I don't think there'll be a long-term victim of it, but they're an immediate and short-term victim of this battle between the two the two warring factions. I think this is what makes Casillas run for president so interesting because Rubiales has upset a lot of people and he's upset a lot of people from day one. I mean,
his first act in the job.
was to sack Julen Lopetegui. And what a baptism that was. I mean, it's funny. I think if you go back to the beginning and look at Rubiales and you think the way he dealt with that, whether you think he did the right thing or not in sacking Lopetegui, and you could argue with the way that Spain's World Cup went, well, he definitely didn't handle it the right way. You can see why he did it.
I still think he was right in principle.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I think you can see but I think the fact that there was such player opposition to him firing Lopetegui, it definitely upset things. I think in terms of taking a stand against Real Madrid thinking they could do exactly what they wanted, and notably, the only one of the Madrid papers that backed Real Madrid over that was, can you have a guess? Marca, obviously. But it was interesting to see a lot of the other Madrid media saying, look, Real Madrid are out of order here.
Yeah.
They've completely mucked up Spain's World Cup bid. But I think what's more important since is the move of the Super Cup to Saudi Arabia. That has put Rubiales in a tricky position. And especially as he was so visibly out there and enjoying the benefits of it, and almost like a conduit for the Saudi tourist board.
Oh, yeah. And also, if we're talking about moral principles in terms of the Lopetegui situation, it then completely under, I mean, that's all washed away when you're just so willing to just get into bed with the Saudis and everything that competition represents.
Miguel, it's interesting that Andy mentions La Liga and the Spanish FA, and because one of my questions was going to be, just from a layman's point of view, is this a move by the Spanish FA to try and get to consolidate more power because they're in a position that perhaps the FA here are in with the Premier League, where the Premier League's kind of got all the aces and all the power, really? Is that kind of why they're trying to do it?
Yeah, completely. It's something that's coming across football now. This is actually another point Tebas made. Now he said it in relation to FIFA and UEFA, but you could thinking about it now, actually, this was surely code about the Spanish FA as well, where you have bodies that are supposed to be regulators of the game and safeguards, and the ones that ultimately their only role should really be to ensure everything in football runs smoothly and interject when there's potential conflicts and potential problems with the game. And instead, they basically see themselves as part of the competition and want their own piece of this massive pie, which you've seen in something like the Super Cup.
Yeah, I mean, the Casillas thing is interesting because he's got this...
The unity candidate.
Yeah, exactly, because he's got this saintly image. I think it's really important. I mean, his whole career really is absolutely fascinating and continues to be fascinating, from the teenager who saved the day against Leverkusen in 2002 to, you know, the cornerstone of Spanish success in the dressing room as much as anything else.
And in relation to the unity candidate thing, when things in the Clásico got really, really poisonous between Madrid and Barcelona when Mourinho was there, and particularly between someone like Alonso and the rest of the Barcelona players, it was Casillas that stepped in,
mediated,
and organised a kind of some sort of conflab with Xavi to ensure that the unity of the Spanish national team wasn't broken. And then they went on and won Euro 2012.
You can put that on your CV, Ika.
Oh, yeah,
that's surely a shoo-in for a job after that.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? It almost is sainthood was reinforced by this massive fallout with Mourinho, to the extent actually, when, like, if you actually looked, if you remove the politics of it, which I realise is very, very difficult in Spanish football, but if you remove the politics of it, Mourinho's sporting case for dropping him, it's a really strong one. It's a really strong one. And when you get to the point where it's 2014, Casillas almost lost them, La Decima.
Totally.
Didn't he? In a season where he didn't play at all in the league. Played just in the Champions League. But for Sergio Ramos, they lose that, and it's all Casillas' fault.
And basically, in that situation as well, I mean, you're right. By that point, it was total sporting merit to drop Casillas. And yet now, but in a wider circumstance, he still looks like he's morally on the right. Especially, I mean, given everything, I suppose, that's transpired with Mourinho's career and how often it's happened where he's basically there's been poison in his dressing rooms and he started calling out players for being rats and all the rest of it, which repeatedly happens. But then in the middle of all that, there's that story about Madrid when it was in 2011 again, when Mourinho was restarting to impose himself in that squad and trying to oust someone like Casillas, which in itself was a power play. I mean, that's the issue, really. It wasn't so much because of sporting reasons. It was also about Mourinho asserting his power in the dressing room full of these figures.
Absolutely.
And there's that story where he was talking to other players about Casillas and someone else, and Casillas overhears from the other side of the training ground, starts shouting, "Hey, mister, that's not how we do things around here."
Right.
And it's again, you're carrying that moral weight against ultimately, you know, politicking.
And it's interesting how he's reinvented himself even further at Porto, because at the start of when he signed for Porto, most best paid player in the history of the club, and he was like a symbol of where Porto had lost it and where they'd moved away from good transfer business and all the rest of it.
He's been there 5 years now, hasn't he?
Yeah, and it's incredible. It looked really unlikely.
Yeah, 2015.
It looked really unlikely, like a year in that he would get an extension to his contract, which he eventually did, because, you know, goalkeepers aren't shirt sellers as well. There was no real commercial reason for signing him either.
He's a handsome lad.
Yeah, he certainly is. Yeah.
And hasn't he got a quite famous wife as well?
So yeah, Sara Carbonaro. Yeah. Who he kissed at the in a TV interview.
That's right. And you had this situation where he made a couple of high profile errors, especially in that first year. He made the big blunder against Dinamo Kiev in the Champions League that eventually stopped them qualifying as well. And he was associated with the Lopetegui era, which went horribly, horribly wrong. And yet, because he's this figure with greater power than being just a great footballer, he actually turned it around at Porto. And when you bear in mind that if you're a player like that, especially a goalkeeper in the Portuguese Liga, that really only really matters how you play unless you're throwing them in left, right and centre. It only really matters how you play in probably 4-5 matches a season, certainly in a league context. So for him to turn it round, recover his form. At one point, there was a mini campaign in Spain, especially when De Gea was having a terrible time, for him to be recalled to the national team. So that shows you how important he still is.
He's only got
176
caps. It's a scandal.
Give him one or two extra.
He is a legend, and we wish him all the very best, of course.
Right, games of the week time. Chaps, this is where you really earn your corn, Miguel. I'll go first, just get mine out of the way. Sunday night, Lazio v Inter is a huge game, third v first, and 1 point separates the top three sides in Italy now.
And especially after Inter's comeback in the Milan derby.
Exactly.
Milan derby.
Amazing. Amazing. One of the best games of the season, that.
I mean, what a reward that is for making this absolutely Herculean comeback. Oh, you're away to Lazio next week. Lazio have won 13 out of 15 in the league and drew the other two.
Well, I was about to say, Lazio haven't lost in the league since the 25th of September. And do you remember who that was to? Inter.
Right, yeah.
So it's come around again.
And Lazio were good for a lot of it.
In the Milan derby, there's another universe that we're all currently living in now where Ibrahimovic scores in the final minute, I think, when he hit the post to make it 3-3. It ends 3-3. Ibrahimovic, at the age of 49, scores two and sets the other one up in a Milan derby.
That would have been one of the worst things to happen for the world. Because the amount of bullshit we would have had to hear about the Ibrahimovic legacy.
What about you just thinking about the think pieces?
I can't stand. I mean, obviously he's a very good player, Ibrahimovic. I just can't stand the persona that goes with it.
Do you know what? First of all, I thought that would have been crazy, and secondly, I thought that's 40,000 words in The Athletic. That. So why is Lazio v Inter on Sunday night? It'll be an amazing game, whatever happens. What about you, Miguel?
Since it is my first time in this podcast, for so many, hopefully.
And you're very welcome.
I'll go for a slightly hometown one, but it is actually a good fixture. I'll go for my my mother's hometown team, Osasuna, who are playing in what many would call a Basque derby. It's not, against Athletic Bilbao.
You're proud Navarran, aren't
Navarran,
you?
Yeah. They're not Basque, even though many will call it that. But it is interesting. I mean, first of all, given the context of the clubs, they're doing both relatively well this season, particularly Osasuna, I think, consolidate their place. And there's always been an interesting tension between the clubs because both have been, obviously, they've both had such good youth academies. But there's always been an issue where, because Athletic Bilbao see Navarrans as potentially part of the greater Basque region, that they can pick Navarrans as, a famous example being Fernando Llorente, they can pick players from that area as part of their...
How does Navarrans feel about that?
It depends, because Navarra, and particularly Pamplona, has always attracted... There has been a lot of Basques there. Anytime you go to Pamplona, you'll see a lot of Basque flags. You'll see a lot of graffiti about how Navarra is not Spain or it's the Basque country. Most Navarrians would consider its own kingdom that's part of Spain. Those sort of politics, it's not as pronounced in other areas. But I think the major tension between the clubs has historically been the idea that Bilbao, for all other people see them as some sort of pure force in the area or around that region, clubs like Osasuna and Real Sociedad would see Bilbao as a big club who just picks off some of their players.
Right. And you kind of got to do that, haven't you? Yeah. If you restrict yourself to only Basque players, you have to really stretch the definition at certain times, don't you?
Does that mean there'll be a bit of spice in this game? Sunday tea time, yeah.
There always is a bit of spice to the game anyway.
Mm. And they're both quite physical sides as well.
I love the idea of this podcast playing a role in a load of people trying to find a way to watch Athletic Bilbao v Osasuna after their Sunday lunch. Great, good stuff. Good first, good debut game selection, Miguel.
Athletic in the semis of the Copa del Rey as well, having beaten Granada this week.
Absolutely, and you talked a bit about the last time Athletic did well in a cup competition or two under Bielsa earlier this week.
Yeah, that's right. And there was an actual genuine Basque derby last week between Real Sociedad and Athletic, which Alex Isak absolutely.
But Miguel doesn't want to talk about that. He's Navarro, mate. It's disrespectful.
It is the scope from certain websites for 6,000 word pieces on Sociedad again, or sorry, La Real, I should say, against Athletic from the 1980s when they both won four titles, when they essentially won four titles in a row.
Yeah, heady days.
Incredible.
That is amazing given the recruitment policy. Yeah. It's incredible.
If you go into a lot of bars in old San Sebastian, they'll have a lot of black and white photos behind the counter of Real Sociedad.
Well, in the 80s, there was colour photos in the 80s. Why not colour? Trying to make it more glamorous than it was.
That's the plan with black and white photos, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like wedding photos.
All right, your wedding photos are definitely in black and white. What's your game of the week, Andy? I've got no idea. I haven't even written it down.
Do you know I love like free football on TV? It's really important.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go for one on Free Sports, which now has its own app if you don't have it on your TV.
Andy's the ambassador for Free Sports. Unpaid ambassador because they give everything away for free, but you cannot move without him mentioning Free Sports.
I'm an ambassador for free football.
Yeah. Do you watch Free Sports?
I don't, no.
No, here you go.
Well, it's in HD now, so...
Yeah. I'm at the point, though, where I go to so many football matches where I actually only rarely watch football on TV.
Right, okay. Purist.
No, not just that. It's just basically because when you're at about 90 games a season, you're free.
Where are you going this weekend?
This weekend, I actually got to go back to Dublin, so I've got no game.
Oh, okay.
But I'm back then for...
You're doing Leipzig next week, aren't you?
No, I'm doing Chelsea United, then I'm doing Dortmund PSG, and then I'm doing Spurs Leipzig, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Andy, sorry.
Yeah, I'll be at Dortmund PSG.
It's a digression.
Yeah, it was.
We can go to a nice bar after.
I'll be at Spurs Leipzig as well, and Andy, be very careful. Actually, you don't even drink, so there's nothing there for you, Miguel. He doesn't even drink beer, so you're not going to...
I'll get a hire car, make myself useful.
Yeah, there you go. Does he let it drive Randy Brassel? Is your full name. Just tell me your game of the week. Is it going to be... Is it on Free Sports? Is it going to be a Portuguese game?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's going to be Benfica versus Braga. We talked about Braga and Ruben Amorim a couple of weeks ago. He finally saw his 100% record as a head coach in the top flight come to an end last week. They were 2-0 up against Gil Vicente and conceded that lead to draw 2-2 in the end. But Braga still absolutely transformed under their new coach. And it'll be interesting then playing Benfica. Benfica have had two really hard games this week, as we said, against Porto and then for Malicao in the second leg of that. They're also missing Gabriel in midfield, who's got a really unusual injury. It's called sixth nerve palsy, and it's some condition that basically affects his sight. He doesn't have clear vision at the moment.
Wow!
So he's a hugely important player to them. He's brilliant for Leganés in Spain, of course, beforehand, and worked pretty hard to get that move to happen. When I say worked pretty hard, went on strike. And he's been great for Benfica, especially in the last year or so. So that they've no idea when he's going to be able to come back. It's a condition that can take up to 6 months to clear. It might even require surgery. They don't know yet. So it's a tough week for Benfica. And I have to say, with the way Braga have played in 2020, they're probably the last opponent you'd want to face in that time, even though they do have a lamentable record at the Estadio de Luz. So that's 6 o'clock on Saturday.
You'd fancy Vinicius to get a few goals in that game, wouldn't you?
Well, he always fancies himself to get a few goals.
I can't believe we haven't heard anything about him. 24, ridiculous amount of goals and a ridiculous amount of appearances.
They're trying to sign him to a new contract already, even though he only signed at the start of the season, just so they can knock that release clause up to ridiculous, no one wants to touch them sort of levels.
Yeah, protect your investments, second tier clubs.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Andy. Brilliant.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces
three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah. You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.